This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is screenwriter and director Paul Thomas Anderson. His new film, Phantom Thread, is nominated for 6 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director. The film's star, Daniel Day-Lewis, is nominated for Best Actor. Day-Lewis has said this will be his final film. Anderson also wrote and directed Heart 8, Boogie Nights, Magnolia, There Will Be Blood, and The Master. His new film, Phantom Thread, has a great score, and it's nominated for an Oscar, too. Phantom Thread is set in 1950s London. Daniel Day-Lewis plays Reynolds Woodcock, a renowned fashion designer who makes gowns for wealthy women and royalty. In the same way he carefully oversees the handiwork in his dresses, he controls the environment around him, allowing no distractions. Early in the film, you get the impression that he typically has one woman who serves as muse and lover. His sister, Cyril, who runs the business end of their fashion house, suggests that he's grown bored with his current muse, and it's time for her to go. After she does go, he discovers his next muse, model, and lover, Alma, a waitress at a small country restaurant who serves him breakfast. Alma is wearing her waitress uniform, but he sees something in her, and soon he's measuring and fitting her for a beautiful dress. She moves in with him, but she's not easily intimidated or controlled. She has the nerve to tell him she doesn't care for the fabric in one of his dresses, to which Reynolds' sister, Cyril, who seems omnipresent, responds that this is the fabric their customers want and find beautiful. Reynolds tells Alma,
Cyril is right. Cyril is always right. It's not because the fabric is adored by the clients that Cyril is right. It's right because it's right. Because it's beautiful. Maybe one day you'll change your taste, Alma.
Maybe not.
Maybe you have no taste.
Maybe I like my own taste.
Yes, just enough to get you into trouble.
Perhaps I'm looking for trouble.
Stop!
As Alma continues to assert herself, Reynolds begins to regard her as a distraction, an intrusion in his ordered world. Is it now Alma's time to leave? If you know Paul Thomas Anderson's movies, you know that the story is going to head in some unpredictable directions. Paul Thomas Anderson, welcome back to Fresh Air. Thank you so much for coming back. A really amazing movie. Of all the kinds of obsessive artists you could have chosen, why did you choose a high fashion designer from the 1950s to build this movie around?
I think they're known to be the most obsessive of obsessives from what I hear. You know, I don't know many of them, so a little bit of it's in my imagination, things that I've read about, particularly guys of this era, the Balenciagas, the Diors, the list goes on. The relationship that they have to their clients was a really rich venue. You know, it kind of lent itself to something very dramatic. It meant that you were going to have clients coming in and going out all day long. The workroom of women was really appealing. You know, I saw a great picture of Dior one time, and there he is at the front of this, literally 300 women in white lab coats, and him at the front. You know, that visually and dramatically was really a great venue for our story.
Well, this seems like a perfectly obsessive role for a very obsessive actor, Daniel Day-Lewis. Did you think about that? Like, did you write the role for him? And did you think, let me give him something super obsessive because he is that way in his approach to acting?
Not that directly. I was thinking very specifically that I wanted to work with Daniel again. So I went to him very early on with a thin premise, which was a relationship movie between a man and a woman. The man has to be self-obsessed, preferably creative and kind of self-consumed. So what happens when a man like that gets ill, creating an opening for the woman in his life to have him vulnerable and open, right? That's the basic premise that I went to Daniel with. So we were in search of a job for this character, this imaginary character that we came up with. And some mutual interest and obsession led us to this fashion world. And yes, Daniel can be obsessive. He's known to be obsessive. But what he is what appealed to me was that he's very good working with his hands, and notably went off and studied how to make shoes a few years back, and he's always tinkering, and he's really good with his hands. He's a great carpenter. Having him sew or do anything practical with his hands seemed to be right up his alley. Backing up from that, one thing before that was that, you know, it had been a long time since I've really seen Daniel be elegant and handsome in a film. You know, usually if you're Lincoln, you're Abraham Lincoln, or the thing that we did together before, you're covered in oil. So there's something very debonair is not the right word, and I'm not sure what it is, but when he gets handsome, it can melt you, and I thought it would be nice to see that again. For me, I like seeing him like that. He's got a great sense of style as well, so it was capitalizing on that for sure.
So he studied for a year with a costume designer for the New York City Ballet in order to get into this role, and he learned how to design himself. And now he's leaving acting, I think, and going into fashion design. At what point did you find out that he intended this to be his final role?
You know, I think the idea that he's going into fashion design in the future is something that the internet might have made up.
Oh, really? Okay.
Or it's perhaps that's just speculation on the part of people who don't know. But once we finished shooting, he made his decision that he didn't want to do it again, which either suggests that he had such a great time doing it that he didn't want to try to top himself, or that the other thing, you know, but I don't think it was either. I think he's spoken about this, so I don't feel like I'm betraying his trust. He's flirted with this or said this kind of thing so many times over the years that I'm not surprised, but I am definitely sad, because it's also unlike him to make public announcements, so it feels as if he's done that for a reason, to kind of put a period at the end of something, which, I don't know, I'm trying not to think about it too much, because I'm greedy and I would like to see more performances by him.
Yeah, well, me too.
Yeah.
So, the fashion designer in this, women's bodies are the infrastructure of the designer's art. And in the movie, this man is always dressing women, not undressing them. And if they're in a state of undress, it's only to be measured so that they can be dressed.
Yes.
So even though there's a kind of strange love relationship at the center of this, it's always about women being dressed. And the clothes, he's a very controlling man, and the clothes are very controlling too. Mm-hmm. Like there's often like a tight-fitting bustier top with surrounded by, say, a stiff-fabriced cape or a stiff-fabriced bottom. And they're beautiful gowns, but, you know, they're not the kind of flowing material that sensually moves with you. can you talk about, let's like start with the clothes. Can you talk about choosing the kind of clothes that you wanted the designer to design so that the clothes reflected him, who he was?
Yeah. I can tell you my input, and then, because the real people to talk to here are Daniel and Mark Bridges. Mark Bridges is the costume designer. You know, initially what started out was in the research, which a lot of this stuff was new to me, learning about Balenciaga, learning about all these designers at the time. You sort of go through this fantastic... They've done nothing if not document their work. You know, there's
can
so
I stop
many
you a second?
Photographs.
What do you wear on a typical day? What are you wearing right now? What are you wearing now? I can't see
well,
you.
I'm wearing a blue Oxford button-down shirt and a pair of very light, kind of a light wool green pants.
Wow, that was way more formal than I expected.
Well, it's funny. My dressing habits somehow got skewed this morning. I was in a t-shirt and sweatpants, and I don't know what happened along the way. And my daughter was watching it happen in front of my eyes. She said, "What happened to you this morning?" And I think I got nervous that I was coming in here, and I, you know, didn't realize it was radio. I thought I had to appear slightly more presentational than I was. And my daughter just sat there saying, "We're late for school. I don't know what you're doing." And I think I was nervous getting dressed, and I wanted to look good on radio. So I don't. That's kind of a classic mistake. It reminded me of when our first child was born. I was so nervous that I think I changed my shirt like 15 times. My wife is like in labor on the couch, and I'm like making sure. So that, I guess it's my panic go-to is to change my clothes a bunch.
Okay, now that we know something about your clothes, let's get back to the designer.
Sorry. Anyway, that was a left turn.
But no, I asked you for it. I wanted to know about you and clothes. Yeah.
You know, one of the worst things that was going to happen was doing a best of costumes or dresses and suits that you like, you know, when you do this research. So we really had to, and it was Daniel saying, right, what do I like? And these decisions came out of Daniel. This character seemed to really enjoy lace. He seemed to like sort of more pastels, kind of color rich purples and pinks. And Daniel's idea was that, look, I'm an Englishman. These are English dresses. You know, they're not French. It's not Dior. It's not sculpture like Balenciaga, but it's English. So this sort of, there's Elizabethan influence, which it's somewhere, you're right. What, you know, this idea that the last thing that I think he would like you to look at is the person inside the dress. He wants you to look at the dress. So, and that's it, kind of where our story starts to get more interesting is when the person inside the dress starts to talk back.
Right.
I'd have to tell you one thing that we found too. Once we went to the V&A, and you know, these beautiful dresses are beautiful, but when you see them laying out, they put them out on a table and you handle them with gloves on, you know, they're between 80 and 200 years old, these dresses that we were looking at, and you have to handle them very delicately, and you're in reverence of them because of the history and the reputation of these dresses. But after like 5 minutes, you're just looking at a pile of fabric on a table. It's actually quite sad. And you instantly realize that unless somebody is in this dress, it's just sort of roadkill. No matter what its reputation or its history is, it needs to be on somebody. I suppose a mannequin would be fine, but preferably a real live human being who can make it move and give something to it.
My guest is screenwriter and director Paul Thomas Anderson. His new film is called Phantom Thread. Part of the movie is about the transformative power of clothing, how it can make somebody feel like beautiful, or it can make them so sad that no matter what they're wearing, they're going to feel ugly. You know, and the Daniel Day-Lewis character, Woodcock, talks about how he sews secrets into the lining, his mother's hair, words, a name, that clothes, you know, can have secrets. But there's also these superstitions surrounding clothing. And there's a monologue. The first time that Alma, the woman who becomes both a model and the love interest, the first time she goes to his home, he tells her the story of making the wedding dress for his mother's second wedding. And I'd like to play that monologue.
I made this dress for her when I was 16 years old.
Beautiful.
It was for her second husband for the wedding. My father had died many years before. Our nanny, the evil Miss Blackwood, the Black Death we used to call her. Because of superstition, she refused to help me sew the dress, as she believed it would bring her bad fortune to never be a bride. Not that anyone would have had her. And she seemed ancient to us. I've no idea how old she actually was, and monstrously ugly. So I worked alone for months and months, hunched over, sewing and sweating and sewing. And the Black Death never married anyway, all the help I could have had from her. It was my sister Cyril came to my rescue in the end. There are endless superstitions when making a wedding dress. Young girls afraid they'll never marry if they touch one. Or models afraid they'll marry only bald men if they put one on.
And where's the dress now?
I have no idea what happened to it. No idea. Most probably turned to ashes by now. Fall into pieces.
And your sister?
What?
Did she ever marry?
No.
So that was Daniel Day-Lewis in the starring role in my guest Paul Thomas Anderson's new movie, Phantom Thread. I think of your movie as being this very unusual hybrid of like ghost story and fairy tale, drama and strange comedy. But let me get to the fairy tale part of it. You know, there's these like magical gowns, which are always in fairy tale. You know, like the princess always has a gown. And and then we get to hear it in that clip that we just heard from Daniel Day-Lewis. The mother's the good witch and the nanny, who they hate, who they call like Black Death or something. She's like the bad witch.
Yeah.
And like the sister and Alma, the woman who he falls in love with, they're kind of each part good witch and bad witch. I wonder if you're, are you interested in fairy tales?
Well, yeah, I mean, enough that, you know, I got a lot of young kids, so over the years they've been floating around my house, you know, and they're there and you can't escape them. And it certainly crossed my mind when getting into this. You couldn't have a girl in a dress without really having to think about these fairy tales.
It's also a ghost story. I mean, Phantom is in the title of the movie. His mother is kind of like a ghost in the story because she haunts his dreams. He sees images of her. He feels like she is watching over him. Are you interested in ghost stories too?
Very much. To the point where I'd like to make one that dealt with it for two solid hours rather than as a kind of a hovering element. That we have it as a hovering element. I'd like to sort of address it dead on. I love the idea of ghosts. I love to think that there are ghosts around me, helping me, coming to me in my dreams. You know, it's always a great feeling when you get visited by somebody from the beyond who isn't with you anymore. I don't know if you have it or not, but
like in dreams, you mean?
Yes, in dreams.
Yeah,
if you've ever.
Yeah, when I dream about, say, my mother or my father, I think of it as a visitation.
Me too. Yeah. You know, it's boy, it feels good. It really does feel good when that can happen. Yeah, it's something that you can really take with you into the future, too. You sort of, I don't know, it usually happens to me at just the right time. I wish it happened more often, but when it does happen, you feel so lucky that they came to say hi.
So something I've read that you said is that there's a scene in which the Daniel Day-Lewis character gets sick. And Alma, his girlfriend, has to care for him. And she finds him particularly tender when he's sick and is appreciating his emotional openness because he's never emotionally open. He's such a kind of controlled, you know, tight person. And you said that that part of the story came from when you were sick with I don't know what, that your wife looked at you with a surprising tenderness. Not that you were surprised she was tender, but it was a kind of look of tenderness that you maybe hadn't seen before. You can describe it better in your own words, but is that what happened?
Yes, I think it's close to that. I think it was more that I had been sick, and I really, really needed her to help me get. I had the flu. It wasn't anything terrible, but I usually kind of battle through my illnesses. And she'll always say, like, "Come on, let me take care of you." I said, "No, I'm fine. I can, you know, I soldier on. I'm like, I'll be pouring sweat and pretending everything's fine." But this one had me flat on my back where I really needed help. And I remember she kind of looked at me with this sweet smirk and smile, like, "Oh, I like you like this." And I think I'd been kind of compounding it by lying in bed watching some of these old gothic horror romance movies that we're talking about. And I thought, well, wouldn't, come on, that's a good idea. Well, wouldn't it suit her to just keep me laying here a little while longer, you know? yeah, I thought that was good. It's like anything, you know, I mean, sometimes it just takes us something to slow down. I think for me, it's slowing down. I mean, I like to keep moving. And yeah, I do have trouble sort of just putting pause on a little bit. And so it's helpful to have something like that kind of smack you upside the head, say, right, slow down, idiot, slow down.
When you were a kid in school, did you like sick days because you were able to stay home and watch TV?
Yes, I did. Price is Right. all the game shows, that was the most exciting thing, was all the game shows were on early doors, like after 9 a.m. It was Price is Right was the main one that I remember. Come on down.
Yeah.
And then it would go into the soap operas for that like 10 o'clock to 11 o'clock hour, and that was really boring. I could not. And then you just would wait until the cartoons would start up again. Yes, that's exactly right, Terry. Did you do the same?
Oh, yeah. And what I used to watch, reruns of Topper. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
I loved that show. And it's a show about ghosts.
Yeah.
Ghosts who only one character can see.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then there were like all kinds of reruns on. So, yeah, I really enjoyed it. And even earlier in my years in radio, I'll tell you the truth, like when the show went national, I got sick once with laryngitis, because it was just like a really bad cold, but I couldn't talk, so there was no point in coming in. I couldn't host the show. And I was so grateful to be sick because I was so exhausted. It like, was a new schedule. Yeah. I was working so hard, and I thought, like, this is the only way I'm ever going to get a rest, because I was working through the weekends and everything. And then looking back on it, I think, like, that's really a terrible way of looking at it. Like, you shouldn't, like, welcome sickness in order to have a break.
Yeah.
So I time my vacations differently now, so that, you know, I always have like some break to look forward to. So I don't think like, well, I hope I get a little sick so I get a break. That's like not good.
No, I mean, I have a friend who's so insane. Every once in a while his life would get so hectic. He said, I just wish I would get in like a minor enough car accident.
Oh, no.
I know. And I thought that's really taking it too far.
No.
But you know, some of this even goes back. I remember, I mean, look, I still have trouble reading a book during the day because it somehow feels indulgent.
Yes,
like you should be like, you know, like, oh my, this is so naughty. I'm actually reading at 10 o'clock in the morning. And I think it's just your upbringing, something about like, mm-hmm. right, get you got to go to work and you got to get in and get move on. And I still, even if this is how I make my living, I still feel guilty. 10 o'clock, I mean, I've sunken into the pleasure of it to think, my God, I've got my life in a way where I can read a book in the middle of the day.
Well, Paul, I've really enjoyed talking with you again. I really enjoyed the movie. Thank you for making the film. Thank you for coming back to Fresh Air.
Terry, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. You're the best.
Paul Thomas Anderson wrote and directed the new film Phantom Thread, which is nominated for 6 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director. The Perfect Nanny by the French-Moroccan writer Leila Slimani is the first much-talked-about novel of 2018. Our book critic Marian Carrigan isn't so sure that's a good thing. Here's her review.
If you've seen the 1945 film noir Mildred Pierce or the 2011 HBO miniseries, both made from James M. Cain's novel, you know that story punishes Mildred for being a working mother. Her marriage breaks up, her younger daughter takes ill and dies, and her elder daughter, Vida, turns out to be a murderer, all because Mildred wasn't in the home 24/7 to oversee things. I feel about Mildred Pierce the same way I now feel about The Perfect Nanny by Leila Slimani. I recognize that it's good art, and I hate how it guilt trips working mothers. The last thing working mothers need to be reading in their nanosecond of downtime is this psychological suspense novel about a perfect nanny who snaps. But of course, they're exactly the audience who will be most drawn to it. Slimani's novel, which has just been translated from the French, is inspired by a real-life horror, the 2012 murder of two children in New York City by their nanny. In Slimani's hands, the unthinkable becomes art. The Perfect Nanny won France's most prestigious literary award, the Goncourt Prize, when it was published there in 2016. Slimani is the first Moroccan-born woman to be so honored. One can see why the judges were wowed. The voice of Slimani's omniscient narrator is chill and precise. Her plot spares neither her character's fates nor her reader's sensibilities. The opening paragraph of The Perfect Nanny warns us this is a story in which the worst can happen, and in fact, just has. The baby is dead. It took only a few seconds. The doctor said he didn't suffer. The little girl was still alive when the ambulance arrived. On the way to the hospital, she was agitated, her body shaken by convulsions. Her lungs had been punctured. As in the true story on which it is based, the broken bodies of the two children are found by their mother. Indeed, the dad in this novel barely registers. The mom here is named Miriam, and she's a lawyer, happy to be working again after a stint of being cooped up with her very young children. The nanny, Louise, is the central enigma of Slimani's novel, a human black hole who relentlessly sucks in and extinguishes the light in the family's life. After its grisly opening, The Perfect Nanny flashes back to Louise's entrance into the family. Miriam, who, like Slimani herself, is Moroccan-French and has confronted racism in Paris, refuses to hire any North Africans. We're told Miriam fears that a tacit complicity and familiarity would grow between her and the nanny, that the woman would start speaking to her in Arabic, asking her all sorts of favors in the name of their shared language and religion. Miriam has always been wary of what she calls immigrant solidarity. The couple interviews a parade of unsuitable women before the bird-like, middle-aged Louise walks in, perfectly perfect in every way. In a few short weeks, Louise takes charge, not only of the two children, but also of their needy parents. Slimani's aloof narrator slowly reveals that Louise obsessively yearns for a second chance to perfect her own flawed mothering skills. Of course, it's an impossible aim, and the pressure mounts. Every evening, Louise returns to a miserable rented room, which she regards as a mere lair, a parenthesis where she comes to hide her exhaustion. Poetic phrases like that one abound throughout Slimani's novel and elevate it well above its formulaic premise, one that has inspired many a Beware the Au Pair Lifetime movie. But the irony is that for all its exquisite craft, the takeaway of The Perfect Nanny is pretty much the same as the message of those movies, as well as of that 1992 cinematic cultural touchstone, The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, as well as of Mildred Pierce, namely, Stay Home, Mom. Surely, it's the enduring masochistic power of that nightmare of maternal inadequacy, rendered particularly vivid here through Slimani's stylistic gifts, that have made this slim novel a number one international bestseller. Talk about a guilty pleasure.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Perfect Nanny by Leila Slimani. Coming up, New York Times reporter John Leland talks about his year-long assignment following six New Yorkers 85 and older. At the time, he was 55, recently divorced, and serving as the main caregiver for his 86-year-old mother. His new book is about what he learned about old age, dealing with decline, and facing death. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest John Leland became known for writing about things associated with youth culture and post-youth culture, But at the age of 55, he started a series of articles for the New York Times about old age. He spent a year with six New Yorkers above the age of 85, including a gay man who had lost his partner 6 years earlier, a woman who was in an intimate relationship with another resident at her nursing home, an African-American man who was a veteran of World War II and a retired civil servant, and a Chinese immigrant who kept her social connections through playing Mahjong. At the same time Leland was writing about their lives, he was the main caregiver for his mother, who was 86, and was dealing with chronic pain from a spinal fracture. As for Leland, he had recently gone through a divorce, was in a new relationship, and was trying to figure out what he wanted from a relationship now as opposed to when he was a younger man. His new book is called Happiness is a Choice You Make, Lessons from a Year Among the Oldest Old. John Leland, welcome to Fresh Air. So I was initially surprised that you were writing about old age because you'd written about things associated with youth culture and post-youth culture, like music. You have a book about Kerouac's book On the Road and why it's still relevant. You have a book called Hip the History. That's a history of what has been considered hip over the years. So when did aging and old age become an interest of yours?
Well, I'm a reporter at the New York Times, and some years ago, I got this assignment called the How We Live team, and each of us were supposed to take two small beats and cover them at the same time. And so I was asked what to do, and I said, well, great, I want to do gay life in the creative class. And my editor said, perfect, you do religion and retirement. And so we really saw eye to eye on that. And I started writing about older people, and it was just completely fascinating to me. You know, my mother is now 89, so I go through all these things with my mother. And the thing about talking to older people or talking to younger people about their parents or their grandparents is it really gets to the emotional part of life really, really quickly. There's just no messing around.
So before you started writing this series about aging, were you afraid of old age at all?
Oh, yeah. And there's times that I still am. And when I started doing the series, I set out to what one of the people I talked to calls rewriting the Book of Job and doing a story on how this is terrible about aging. And you fall down and you break your hip and then it's all over. And you lose your eyesight and then your friends all die and then it's over. And your heart stops working and you don't have sex anymore and you don't work and you don't have anything that gives you purpose. So now it's all over. And that's what I thought old age was. But then you spend time with people and a lot of that stuff is a part of their lives in old age, but in no case was it how they define themselves. So it wasn't getting at what the truth about their lives was as they saw it.
One of the real issues for people, I think, is what is it like or what will it be like to carry on without your life partner or spouse? And one of the people you spoke with, John, who had been partners with his companion Walter for 60 years, you know, outlived him. I think he was dead for 6 years by the time you talked to John. Walter had been dead for 6 years.
That's right.
And did John want to find another companion afterwards? And I should say they weren't married because a legal gay marriage, you know, marriage equality came after Walter's death. So I think I'm right on that, that it was too late for them.
That's right. And it's one of the heartbreaking things on that because Walter died before they could legally marry in New York. And as a result, John was not eligible for Social Security survivor's benefits from Walter's life. And so he lived on about half of what he would have lived on had they been a married couple. He did have friends that he loved, and his friends were almost a generation younger than him, so he wasn't losing them right and left. But going on without your partner, it's tough. Nobody wants that. But there's some people that will find another mate. One of the people in the study, Helen Moses, had met her husband in kindergarten, and they'd gotten together right away, and they were together until his death, about 50 years after they got married. And she thought it was over for her, and she was in a nursing home, and she met a man named Howie, and they just took up together, and they were inseparable.
Well, you watched Helen think through whether she wanted to get married or not to Howie, the man she met in the nursing home. And, you know, the cons were the kind of thing you mentioned, you know, that responsibility of caring for the person and the pain of it, the pain of losing somebody so close. But there are some pluses she saw to the possibility of marriage, too. What were those?
Well, it would be they would get their own room together. They would have sex. Helen said, oh, you're never too old for sex. I'm not too old for anything. I think, you know, Helen would say she's from the old school. She didn't believe in premarital sex. I think part of that was just talk. I don't think she was that interested in it, but maybe more physical intimacy and going to bed with a man and waking up with that man. I think that was something she wasn't going to do without marriage. So maybe that's it, that additional closeness that comes to couples when they get married, when they made a formal tie to each other. But, you know, Helen's 93 now, so were she to get married, there's the possibilities were really great that in a fairly short period of time, one would die on the other, and that's really hard to deal with.
So did Helen and Howie ever get married?
Helen and Howie are still not married, and I think Helen will often say that she wishes she could get married, but I don't think she really does. I think she's got that perfect equilibrium where she is at the center of this love triangle involving her daughter and her partner, and she's the focus of both of their attention, and she's able to focus her attention on both of them, and I think that's the best of all worlds for her.
So Helen had told you that, you know, if they were married, they could have sex because she doesn't believe in premarital sex. And I'm wondering what sex means to her, just in terms of its importance, but also how she would define sex now. She would define sex differently than she used to. You describe them spending time in bed together. They have separate rooms in the nursing home, but they'd watch TV together in the same bed. And then, you know, one of them would leave and return to their room. So I'm just wondering what, if this isn't too forward to ask, what level of physical intimacy they have with each other or what level she wishes that they had.
Well, Helen would open that door, and when I would try to walk into it, she would close it down. Helen would say, I'm from the old school. You're asking very personal questions. Tell us about you and your girlfriend. No, I'm not going that way with you, Helen, either. So I don't know. I would imagine that sex involves a certain making yourself vulnerable, that sitting in the bed together and watching TV together doesn't quite do. But that's really me projecting myself onto it. So I'm not sure what she meant by that.
I think it was the person who's a World War II veteran and retired civil servant who said that he just couldn't fathom that no one else he knew remembered World War II or the Depression. And It just made me think about how at a certain age, when you've outlived everybody you know, and when the people you do know are younger, how easy it would be to feel like you're from a different world than they are, that your baseline is different, your set points are different, your whole frame of reference is different, and that maybe there's not really a place for you anymore in the world as it exists.
Well, I think that's a great point, and a lot of people feel left behind by technology. The smartphones are beautiful things, but not if your hand shakes. You know, if you have a slight tremor in your fingers, that device becomes, you know, just a brick in your hand, and it's useless. And so a lot of people felt left behind by that. And like for most of human history, we could turn to these elders for wisdom because they knew about what it meant when that cloud structure came or when the animals would migrate. And that kind of knowledge, we have Google for that now. So people felt left behind by technology. And John Sorensen was the man who said he couldn't imagine that people didn't know what, didn't remember World War II or the Depression. Mm-hmm. And John was a 90-plus gay man, so his generation of men had had a particular, you know, devastation in the 80s and 90s.
Right. So he lost a lot of his cohort to the AIDS epidemic.
Yeah.
One of the things you got to observe is the infrastructure for older people, whether it's the nursing home or the home health care aide or the family that lives close by. I don't know if there was like Meals on Wheels kinds of things involved in what you observed. But standing back and looking at the different versions of the infrastructure for the aging that you came across, what are some of the things you'd really like to see that you weren't seeing enough of?
That's a great question. I think what people do really well in is when there's possibilities for interaction and closeness and making decisions in their own lives. I didn't have an experience with writing about anyone who was in a bad nursing home. There are a lot of bad nursing homes where there's just not enough staff and people are confined to their beds for long periods of time. So that's really bad. But even in the good nursing homes, the residents there often aren't making decisions of what sort of life they want, what kind of activities they want, what kind of interactions they want, what they want to eat, when they can eat. And I think that's something that as the baby boom generation gets into that slightly more dependent state, they're not going to accept being told, well, okay, Terry, you eat at table 9 at 8:30. I think we'll want something where we have all the supports that people need or that we need, but we want more individual decision making.
Do you have a DNR?
Oh, I'm so terrible with record keeping. I did finally make a will, but a DNR is slightly beyond me.
Have you thought about if you do get around to making one, what you'd want in it? Because I think they're getting more and more detailed as time goes on.
I think so. And there's an interesting thing. They're starting to do a sort of a cognitive breakdown or a dementia DNR to make decisions about how far is too far.
I was just reading about that in your newspaper.
Yeah, a great article by Paula Spann, who's, I think, wonderful. But there was a study by the British Psychiatric Association of people with Alzheimer's. And they asked them about their quality of life. And they asked their, I think it was their health proxies, which is typically their kids, about their parents' quality of life. And all the time, the people with the dementia rated their quality of life much higher than their kids did. And even as the disease advanced, the people with it still rated their quality of life as high, whereas their kids thought their quality of life was getting lower and lower and lower. So they still had cognitive challenges, you know, things that challenged their minds, and they still had people that come to see them. So it raises questions about advanced directives, because if a certain level of dementia looks like a life that's not worth living to you now, when you're in it, there's the possibility that it won't look like that at all to you. So it makes that kind of complicated. And the Bridges study was very, very small, so it's not conclusive in any way. But I think it's really fascinating.
Yeah, so that leads to this question. Has the line shifted for you for when you think you'd want to die? At what point you think life would no longer be worth living, if it ever comes to that point? And what I mean by that is it's often not a choice. You're dead. it's not always a kind of slow process. Yeah.
I think if we think of old age as another country, I've become less confident in the ability of the people who have never visited this country to make life and death decisions about it. In other words, someday I'm going to be there and I can make this decision now about what constitutes a life worth living. But the way I look at it in 20 years or 10 years might be entirely different. There was an essay a couple of years ago by Ezekiel Emanuel, who's an oncologist and was one of the architects of the Affordable Care Act. It ran under a headline something like, Why I Want to Die at 75. And it didn't quite mean that. It was about why he didn't want extraordinary measures or life-prolonging measures after he was 75. And those included like flu shots or vaccines. But he felt that, boy, everything after 75 is the far side of the slope. And if I set this directive now, I'll live more fully in the years I have before that. Now, I agree with the second part of that, that if you knew when you were going to go, you would live more fully in the time you have now. I just don't think there's anything stopping us from doing that. But I do think when he gets to be 75, he might think about that question a lot differently, and he might want that flu shot.
Yeah, right. So what are some of the examples of ageism that you see around you that really irritate you most?
Oh, I think that every person over a certain age can tell you that they hate being called sweetie or hun or dear. Oh, Terry, you're 80 years young.
Oh, the years young thing. Yeah.
No, I am not years young. I'm years old. And the daughter of Ruth Willig, who's the woman who had to move out of her assisted living facility, and her daughter's kind of a very forceful woman, she would be out with her mother, and someone would say, oh, your mother's so cute. And she would say, my mother is not cute. You know, my mother went to college during the war and became a microbiologist. My mother is tough. She raised four kids, and she went through the Depression, and she is not cute. She's smart, she's loving, she's wonderful, but she's not cute. So that's the kind of ageism that can just really stick in your craw.
There's something like so unbearably patronizing and condescending about that, as if being older and even being, you know, having lost certain functions is an embarrassment that has to be kind of covered up with these meaningless terms posing as terms of endearment, but are really terms of condescension.
Oh, yeah, because you're in the position to call that older person dear. You know, that's setting up a relationship between you guys that you're not equal. And they're grateful to have you call them dear or hide that they're old by calling them 101 years young. You know, it would be so offensive, I think, to any of us.
John Leland, thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
John Leland's new book is called Happiness is a Choice You Make, Lessons from a Year Among the Oldest Old.